All right, I think we're ready to get started.
It's already 7 minutes past the hour, so we'll try to stay on time. So this is the combined November-December Blue Waters user webinar. November was a busy month for many people, so we decided to push it into December, and the third Monday in December wasn't going to be very good for most people either, so we'll have a combined one. Let me get to the end here. So the topics for today that we sent out last week, one is we'll discuss briefly about the NSF announcement for the new PREC proposals. We'll go over some upcoming changes to the Blue Water system, a couple items there. We'll discuss current usage and a new usage tool on the portal. We'll revisit that. Briefly discuss a reminder for the NSF PREC teams to work with their point of contact on developing science team details. And then we'll conclude with Ryan Mokos from the Science and Engineering Application Support Group here. He's going to talk about data management best practices regarding using Globus Online and Blue Waters Nearline system. That's going to be a condensed version of the presentation that he gave at the user workshop last week. So first, the announcement came out early last week, that NSF's starting up the allocation process again for petascale computing resource allocation. That's the PREC group here. And I linked into the PDF the actual URL under the program solicitation, changed numbers, reflecting the resumption of the PREC proposal process. And one thing to note is the first deadline is this March 2014, but then from then on, their subsequent deadlines are in November. So we'll have basically two allocation processes in 2014, and then after that it'll be once a year until 2016. And there's been a change in program officer for the PREC allocation process, so Rudy Eigman will be our program officer. And if you go through and read the proposal, there's some slight changes to the allocation process, one of which is how we ask for resource requirement specification. So I think back in the original proposal, that was in terms of either whatever unit I think was used at the time, probably SUs perhaps. So we, now that we've been in production for a while, are allocating everything in terms of node hours. I know people on the call are probably used to that, but if you're talking to anybody who's considering applying for an allocation, the idea is to convert things into node hours. And if you look at the proposal, there'll be a link in there to a page on the portal which talks about converting usage requirements on different systems to bringing it over to Blue Waters. It's not necessarily, if I get performance X on one host, and what will I get on Blue Waters? It's basically talking about how to view the cores, the floating point cores and the integer cores on the Blue Water system. And with the charging and whether or not if we use the exceed concept of a service unit and scaling that by HPL, which we don't. Anyway, so we're happy that's out, and we look forward to bringing on some new groups onto the system. System changes coming up. So we have two that we're going to implement hopefully this week, probably tomorrow. One of which is a minor one, changes to purging on the scratch file system. We'll discuss that. One is a little more detailed that our lead admin, Jeremy Enos, will discuss. We'll provide some detailed information as well. I have one slide on it, and we'll talk about it a bit more. And then something that will occur next month in January, we're going to update the default programming environment to the more current versions of some interesting functionality that's coming out. Provided by some of the newer compilers and some of the newer MPitch available. So changes to scratch purging, that's been in place for a while. That's dealt only with files so far. The storage group decided that they also want to make sure they start purging empty directories. So it's a fairly minor change. The policy will be the same as the files, last accessed and last modified within greater than 30 days. So if you have a directory that's empty and hasn't been used in 30 days, it'll get purged. Since this wasn't implemented in production, some users might be accustomed to having certain directories being persistent on the scratch file system that they always assume are there. So if you have JavaScript that check for that move that use certain directories that you don't check the status of that directory first. We invite you to make appropriate changes to your JavaScript, and that'll we'll probably start implementing that tomorrow. So the first purging, I believe, for directories will start probably right away once that policy gets implemented. And we document this on the Blue Waters portal under the storage section of the user documentation.
What's the motivation?
What is the motivation? I think the storage group would prefer not to have too many, I guess, I don't know if it's with respect to inodes, or they find that there's some groups are generating thousands, will have thousands and thousands and thousands of empty directories out there.
I see.
If you've run thousands of jobs. So it's a matter of keeping the system clean, I guess, from that point of view. It's not because of...
Just inodes.
So it's not a matter of actual utilization of the system. It probably reduces metadata load as well, metadata volume. I don't have an accurate count of actually how many directories would be purged. I know routinely with files, for purging will be on the order of tens of thousands of files, so it could be potential.
It also may make it clearer to various users as to the presence of data or not, whereas just seeing the directory structure there can sometimes give a quick and incorrect representation.
Okay, so a more substantial change to the system that we'd like to discuss is change to how the nodes are handed by one part of the subsystem, which is ALPS, which is basically the part that handles things like app run, things that the users interact with there. Those nodes are provided to the resource management system of Moab and Torque in a certain order, and initially the default that Cray came up with resulted in the picture on the left here in the bottom left corner with the X, Y, and Z labeling for the dimensions. So this is a view of the 3D torus, and each colored sphere represents a Gemini, which has two compute nodes on it, either XE or XK, and the colors correspond to a particular job. So the red spheres all belong to one job, the pink spheres all belong to another job, et cetera, et cetera. And this current default NID orientation or node allocation, the jobs tend to align themselves along the XZ direction, or XZ slab. Usually 4 thick in Gemini node count, which would be 8 nodes thick in terms of node count. So that's our current orientation. Now, we've had some studies over the last year, specifically with people from our group, the Science and Engineering Application Group, and with Bob Fiedler, our application support person from Cray, on improving application performance. And many times we've discovered that applications that get nodes allocated more in what would be called XZ slabs, so slabs that look over on the right-hand side, where you might see that lavender-colored or that green-colored set of Geminis that an application is running on, have substantially improved aggregate network bandwidth. And we've done several tests in the last couple months where we set up a default configuration, run a bunch of jobs, then Jeremy makes the change to how the nodes are allocated to Web and Torque, and then we rerun the same workload, they get a different allocation, and we compare the performance, the time to solution for the applications. And for almost all applications, we either see no change in performance or modest to substantial change in performance. I think we've only seen one application that tends to not always do well with the new NID orientation, but we're working with that application to handle their jobs in a different way. So we think that this overall change will improve time to solution for many applications as a whole and improve the overall quality of application performance on the system. One thing that's not really highlighted here in these pictures, because these are really focusing on XE node jobs, is that the XK region, which isn't clearly identified in the torus representation, has some challenges to how jobs need to be allocated within the XK regions, the XK X dimension spans more than one half the torus dimension in X, so there could be some wraparound traffic there if the jobs aren't, if the nodes for the jobs aren't properly allocated. And Jeremy has shown me some nice animations, which we haven't made available here, unfortunately, because the animation is a little slow. Shows a nice way of how that node filling is handled. And we just lost. I'm not too sure if people on the call can still see the presentation. Steve, are you still there?
I'm here, and I got the PDF file, so I'm fine.
Okay. So maybe Bob Fielder, if you're on, do you still see the presentation?
Yeah, I still see it. Please report the graded performance to us up there.
Right. So for some reason, we've lost either my computer or our display is gone. So
I just got, oops, the host hasn't started this web conference yet. Please try again in a couple minutes.
All right. I'm not sure. Looks like my graph, maybe just the laptop went on the screen. So I'm just going to pull this out here and see if I can continue on.
Just a couple of comments on that net order change first. So this is going to happen tomorrow morning. The little background on the allocation that Greg had been describing, the Cray default allocation had the benefit from Cray of having a Hilbert space filling curve to try and keep nodes as contiguous as possible within a job set. Now, that same mechanism is used for the other allocation in the plane, but as you mentioned, the global aggregate bandwidth is higher in the XZ planes than it is in YZ planes, Y being the slowest dimensional bandwidth of all of them, Z being the fastest. X and Z are very similar in their capability, but Y is distinctly slower as every other one crosses a half bandwidth kind of barrier. So we do expect to see a much improvement here in overall application bandwidth. The ones that will have a potential for suffering from this change will be those that are more hop sensitive and latency sensitive, at least it's our expectation. But we have steps where we can mitigate that too if you find yourself susceptible there.
So for people who are on the call who are familiar with some of the applications, the one application that we've noticed that seemed to suffer a bit, at least the way the problem was set up, would be NAMD. So NAMD tends to be more latency limited in how it's run. Applications that do better would be, for example, applications that either suffer from a fair amount of network congestion, depending on how they're placed on the torus, for example, lattice QCD codes, or, for example, applications that require a lot of aggregate memory bandwidth for 3D SSTs, such as a turbulence application. So those two latter ones do benefit substantially for using XZ sheets or a NID layout that have preference in XZ.
Yep, and in the later tests, we also had seen NAMD actually improve substantially as well with the new layout. Now, our tests were done with a layout of applications on a clean system, so this does not solve the fragmentation issue yet, but it does open us up to future solutions that we have planned for addressing fragmentation within the torus as well. So be watching mail for updates on hints towards job submission parameters that can help alleviate some of these issues as we're able to test them further. But we know that this NID ordering change should provide some immediate impact. And we're very interested in hearing any recorded observations that you have, slower or faster, as a result of this. That's why we want to make sure that we pin this down as the morning of the 10th, where this change will occur. And then jobs that launch after that point will be allocated the different order.
Right. So we'll send out a subsequent announcement noting that. And we ask that users who are running on the system pay attention to jobs where they can kind of compare either step times, time to solution for similar jobs to let us know if they're seeing substantial performance degradation. So we've tested about 12 different applications in a variety of workload forms, and most of those were at scale. We didn't test a lot of small applications, so we're trying to target quality of service for the larger application. So there's an email, the help plus BW email is the normal place to send your information, and for the NSF TREC teams, the point of contact, so we'll work with you if there's something amiss with node allocations and if it's substantially impacting performance. And for anyone else on the call, the normal support mechanisms will be in place as well. So we're pretty excited about this, and we hope that it gets a improved time to solution for a majority of the workload.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
Do the allocation of slabs, do these slabs that the blocks of allocations you're getting, are they any thinner when you have the orientation so that it's normal to Y, or is it the same thickness?
They're thinner. They're too thick in Y, where the allocation, the previous allocation, as you can see from the diagram there, will represent most of those jobs as 4 thick in X. When we swing that plane up into the XZ plane out of the YZ, then we've also made them too thick instead of 4 thick. Reasoning for that being that the Y modules are on the same mezzanine for 2, and it prevents the Y from crossing the cable. Now, that's not to say we didn't do a test with 4 thick and Y as well for an XZ sheet. And that test actually surprised us where it had about equal performance with the 2Y thick. But having more question with it and less predictability and a more crude allocation as to what was available for us for the space filling curve, we opted to go with the 2 thick for the least cost, least risk, and most predictability.
Okay, that helps a lot.
Sure.
All right, any more questions, send us an email and we'll be sure and try to address those. So changes to the programming environment. Last time we did a programming environment change was just after the XK nodes came back from the upgrade of just over 4,000 XK nodes. It's been a little while. We try to limit it to no more than 4 times a year to make default changes to the programming environment. We just got a release of the Cray programming environment last week that we're getting installed on our test system and on Blue Waters, and has some interesting additional functionality and support that we would like to push up as default. So in January, probably the second week of January, we'll be moving to the default modules shown here. I didn't list everything because there's too many to show, but probably some of the more important ones for some of the groups on the call would be that the Cray compiler now supports the use of AVS intrinsic. So if you're using SSE intrinsics that you have developed for GNU or PGI, use now with the Cray compiler. I don't know at the moment if it supports inline assembly. That was something that I had a look at. I'm not too sure. I think some of the heads are shaking no, but at least we're partway there with the AVX compiler intrinsic, so that's a good sign. PGI, we're getting a little bit old in our default PGI compiler, so I think we're at 13.6, and we'd like to move to the most current one. So 13.10 came out for our platform last week, and there's additional discussion for improvement for OpenACC support. Support 13.9 was the first one that came out with default support for CUDA 5, and now we're running at CUDA 5.5. So CUDA 5 it works just fine on the system as well, so the default mode for PGI would be 5 support node. That would add quick. Just a minor revision change for GNU to fix some bugs from 4.8.1 to 4.8.2. Cray MPI environment MPP, which is the Cray and Pitch module, has additional further development on improvements to GPU to GPU communication through MPI. And so we'd like to get those in use for users of the XK nodes. We'll make some notes when we send out the announcement when the changes are made. There are some changes to some of the environment variables. I think, for example, the CUDA proxy environment variable has changed name, so we'll have to mark those up as well when we send out the announcement. So that'll be probably the second week of January, so we're just giving people a heads up. And there'll be some other changes to LibSLI, LibSLI ACC, and Perp tools. So usage to date, we're over halfway through our calendar year for allocation that started April 4th, so we are taking into account the XK outage, which was roughly almost a month. We are 60% into the year, allocation year. So we'd hope to see that most allocated groups are somewhere around that amount of allocation used. And you can see in the table above the different three largest groups and allocated groups. And it's the PRAC, the Illinois allocation, and GLCPC are at different levels of percent allocation used. There are two largest teams, Vidalian and the NSF-PREC allocation group that are greater than 70% used, so we're very happy with that usage. That's great. However, the next largest 12 projects within the NSF-PREC group are less than 50%, and those are the groups that we're concerned about. As we get closer and closer to the end of March, it'll be more and more difficult to use your allocation. Some teams are quite far behind on the use of their allocation. So we are trying to come up with ideas of how to mitigate some of the pressure that's going to start to appear on the system when utilization starts to peg at high 90s and people won't be able to get all their allocation consumed by the end of the allocation period. So that's something that PIs need to, and delegates or PIs need to keep in mind is to monitor the usage of your team and encourage the usage of your team. Some teams are doing a very good job of that. To facilitate that, and this came out in the last call, but I just want to reiterate that on the portal there's a graphical tool now for monitoring usage. You don't just have to use the command line version on the system itself, so it's open and visible, just like most of the Exceed allocations through the XDmod. And you can drill down to individual teams and users to see usage patterns and understand the usage of your own team, for example, if you're asking a question about how the usage is being consumed. And I hope to announce at some point that the Blue Water Speed for XDmod will be available for public viewing pretty soon. We've been working hard on that. Should hopefully be maybe within the next month. I'm not too sure, but it's getting close. So it'll be available as a feed into the XDmod site for people familiar with the Exceed XDmod website. This is our usual disclaimer for getting access to publications and presentations that various researchers are doing on the system. So we'd like to know about publications, especially publications that are coming out soon that you have in the pipeline that are accepted, for example, not waiting until after they've been published to let us know. We'd like to relay that information to our project officer as quickly as possible. The NSF has expressed a lot of interest in the results of the science on the system. And so we urge you to share that information as often and as soon as you can. And, of course, the NSF PREC team members should let their point of contact know when they have information available. All right, so next up is Ryan Mokos. He's going to give us a presentation that is very topical in nature. We've had a modest number of users asking about... Globus Online, probably more questions than we were anticipating. And make sure this doesn't work here. There we go. So we had a presentation made for our workshop, which is that Ryan presented last week about how best to use Globus Online and the Nearline subsystem, the HBSS Nearline system.
Okay, thank you. All right. Yeah, so Greg said this is basically the same thing that I presented last week, although there was actually, I was actually just doing some testing today and found out that there's one change that needs to be made to this, which was actually found out in like the last 20 minutes.
Okay.
But I'll mention that when we come to it. So the slides have not been updated for that yet, but we'll make sure the correct copy is online. Okay, so, so first I'll just go over the, I'll go over briefly the hardware for the nearline system, which is also referred to as HBFS, which is the software that's running on it. I'll go over the file system structure, basically how data is transferred to and from Blue Waters. I'll go over Globus Online, which has two different interfaces, both a web GUI and a command line interface. And I'll also go over some ways of trying to make the most of your transfers. So this is a slightly outdated graphic of the entire Blue Water system. The only part that's not up to date actually is the GPU nodes. There should be a few more of those, but otherwise, I've grayed out most of the main part of the machine, left kind of the important paths here for data colored. And so basically, as you can see, so you have, when you write data on the system, it goes out through the LNET nodes, goes through the InfiniBand fabric and goes to the, you're storing to disk. So the Synexion storage there, so that's home, scratch, and projects. And then from there, the data can either go to the outside world through the import-export nodes, or you can send it to the HPSS system, and then the route there, as you can see, goes through the import-export nodes and then through the data mover nodes. Here's another representation of the data path here, with a few more statistics on the actual hardware. You have Scratch Home and Projects on the left there. Data goes through the import-export nodes and then either out to the internet or to the HPSS system. And then you can take that HPSS system part and blow that up to this. And so here you see data comes in through the mover nodes and then goes to the nearline storage. And so HPSS has two main hardware components to it. So there's the tape, of which we have about 360 petabytes worth of storage. Then there's also disk cache. And so normally when you write, so most of the time when you're writing, so as long as you're writing files that are less than 8 terabytes, the files will first be stored in the disk cache, and over time they'll be written to tape. If it's over 8 terabytes, then the file will be written directly to tape.
On slide 4, is there a typo where it says 100 times 40 gigabyte Ethernet to HPSS?
That's a good question. I didn't actually write that in there, so I'm not positive. That does seem a little large. I know the aggregate bandwidth between Scratch and the HPSS system is supposed to be at least 100 gigabytes per second.
That's why this seems quite extreme.
Yeah, that's I think maybe a factor of 5.
Okay. And when you switch slides, could you mention it for those of us who are following them ourselves?
Oh, sure. Sorry about that.
Thanks. That's okay. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm moving on to slide six. Okay, so the HBSS file system basically looks just like Lustre does. So you have a home directory with a five terabyte quota. So that quota cannot be increased, but you also have access to a project directory. Again, same path that you see on Lustre. And so that has a 50 terabyte limit, but we can increase that. You just need to let us know. Create a ticket or send an email to LSBW at NCSA, and that'll create a ticket. Let us know, why you want more storage, how long you need it for. Although I guess presumably that would probably be for the rest of your project. And as the last bullet point says, this is not like scratch, data is not purged. So you get to keep access to that data for the life of your project. Moving on to slide seven. So there are three main ways of looking at data transfer on Blue Waters. So first, you have between Blue Waters Lustre and the HPSS system. For that, you pretty much have to use Globus Online. You can't use tools like SCP or SSCP. And then there's transferring data between Blue Waters and the outside world. And so whether you're transferring to Lustre or HPSS, so while you can technically use SCP, SSCP, and RSync, we really don't want you to do that. And the main reason for that is because all of that, so if you use those tools, the data is going to go through the login nodes. And as there are only four login nodes and hundreds of users, they tend to really bog down the login nodes. I mean, we've seen performance of the logins be hit by, like we've seen performance take a hit of a factor of 10 or more, even with just a few RSync processes running. So it's very important that you don't transfer data that way. So we'd like everybody to use Globus Online. And it's also to your advantage because transfers through Globus Online are almost always faster, especially for large amounts of data. And then the third type of transfer that I hadn't even thought about until someone told me about it a few months ago is you can actually transfer data from the Lustre file system to the Lustre file system using Globus. So you can transfer from home to scratch, from scratch to home, scratch to projects, or even scratch to scratch if you want to. As you can see from my example there, Globus is significantly faster if you're transferring a decent number of larger files. And the main reason for that is because Globus can transfers files in parallel, as opposed to something like just the copy command cp, which is going to transfer things in serial.
In addition to that, just to bridge that connection back to the diagram you saw of the system earlier, there are 28 IE nodes that are then tasked with that IO rather than the single login node running CP. So if you do have a lot of files, that is the faster way to move them.
Yeah. So if you are transferring files using Globus, yeah, you're using the import/export nodes and the data mover nodes rather than the login nodes. So that's that's where the transfers are offloaded to. So moving on to slide 8, this just gives you a graphic of where to find the how to access Globus Online using the portal. So we have some resources on the portal, page on documentation, as well as a page that tells you how to use Globus. And then if most supercomputing sites have Globus Online endpoints set up already, so you can use those, or if you have a local cluster that doesn't have it, or if you want to transfer data from your laptop or desktop or something like that, you can use Globus Connect to set up an endpoint for your local system. Slide 9. So this is basically how you see Globus Online after. So you have to sign into your Globus account, and then if you go through, you click on that Globus Online button on the last slide, so then you'll get this data transfer page. And so the two endpoints associated with Blue Waters are Blue Waters and Nearline. Let's show it there. So for transferring, for doing transfers through the GUI, it's very simple. You just click on your source and destination files or directories. You set up the source endpoints, select your files and directories, and then just hit the button to transfer one way or the other. And they're also, if you see down in the lower left-hand corner there, it says more options. So there are a few different options there that you can also select for your file transfers. So Globus can do a few different things, like, so you can have it overwrite files at the destination, or you can have it just update files, different things like that. So that's potentially worth checking out, especially if you're just trying to freshen a directory rather than copying an entire thing. Now the GUI does have some limitations. So some parameters that the Globus has are not accessible through the GUI. There's also a 100,000 file maximum that the GUI will list for you. So usually not an issue, but sometimes if you are creating many, many files, that could be an issue. And it's also, at the moment, it's also not, you also are not able to get full concurrency using the GUI. So moving on to the next slide 10. So command line interface gives you access to all the parameters. It will get you full concurrency available right now. And you can also, using the command line interface, you can also put those commands in scripts. So the only real disadvantage is it does take a little bit of time to learn, but it's not really that complicated. And it is a little bit verbose. You see an example of a transfer there. So basically you have to connect to their SSH server and give it a command. And so there are two different ways you can do that. Either you can log in, you can just do SSH into the cli.globusonline.org, and then you can issue commands from there, or you can issue commands like you see here without getting into their system. Moving on to slide 11. I just explained the first bullet point. So this just talks about a number of the things you can do with command line interface. You can transfer, files or entire directories recursively. You can check the status of your transfers. You can cancel transfers. You can do basic system commands like ls and make directory. And so one advantage here with ls is, like you can do an ls-l and get more information on the file. So that's something you cannot do with the GUI. And again, there's documentation on the portal. And if you do log into their server and type help, then you can access the man pages for the different commands. Moving on to slide 12. So one important note about moving files on the HBSS system. So when you use Globus, so doing a normal transfer or using the GUI, you're only copying files. You're not actually moving them. So to actually move them, you need to use the rename command to the CLI. So that's the only way that you can actually move files. And that's particularly important if you're trying to move files like between your home directory on HBSS to your projects directory on HBSS. So slide 13. So for optimizing transfers. So normally the GUI does pretty well. If you just want to transfer a bunch of files, you have maybe a couple terabytes of data. Using the GUI should be just fine. But if you're transferring tens or hundreds of terabytes or even petabytes of files, and you really need to get the most performance out of it, then you probably want to use the command line interface. So we recommend that you transfer large files, preferably in the gigabyte or more range. A lot of that has more to do with really taking advantage of the available bandwidth. You certainly can transfer small files, and you can transfer large numbers of small files with Globus, but you're not going to see nearly the performance that you do if you transfer larger files. And if you want help in your applications with trying to aggregate data or something like that, so you're writing larger files, or if you're just writing like a couple really large files and you want to break that up, so you can get better concurrency doing your data transfers, just working with smaller files, just let us know and we can help with that. Create a ticket. So the maximum concurrency that you can get on Blue Wires right now is 20 files per transfer. And at most you can have up to three active transfers going at any one time. So you can queue up more than that, but only three will be active at any one time. So you can potentially get up to 60 files being transferred at any one time. So slide 14. So these are three transfer parameters that you can add to the CLI transfer command that you can use to kind of help tune your transfers. So the first one is the parallelism level dash P, and so that honestly I haven't. So I've played around with that, and at least for larger, like if you're trying to transfer like at least a few dozen files, I haven't really seen that do anything. So I haven't really seen it make a difference, so I wouldn't really worry about that right now. So dash CC, the concurrency, so that can be important, if you want to set higher concurrency, you want to set that as high as you can. And the pipeline depth specifies the number of files that you get per control channel, and then as you can see, the number of control channels is the same thing as the concurrency. The pipeline, adjusting the pipeline depth can be useful for higher latency connections. For example, if you're transferring between Blue Waters and some other supercomputing site like TAC or something, especially if you're using smaller files, it can be useful to pipeline those. Now on Blue Waters, so at least transferring between Lustre and HPSS, so we recommend that you do not set parallelism. And so the one difference here in the slides I was talking about before, so actually I was playing around with this, and actually you are able to get the full default 20 concurrency on Blue Waters if you use the CLI transfer command and do not set CC. If you don't set the concurrency, then it does default to 20. So that's something that needs to be changed on the slide, and that's something that we'll make sure we update on the portal as well. And you definitely want to set the pipeline depth to 1 for Blue Waters. Because of such a low latency connection, you don't gain anything by pipelining. All you end up doing is, especially if you're only transferring like a modest number of files, like maybe 50 or so, then what the pipelining will end up stacking a whole bunch of files in each control channel, and so you'll end up with a smaller concurrency. And as it is, if you look, see the important note that I have here, so the minimum queue length is 2 anyway. So the only way that you can take full advantage of the concurrency available is to have at least 2 times the number of files. So if you want to take advantage of the concurrency of 20, you have to be transferring at least 40 files. And so then if you set the pipeline depth higher, then you'll see even fewer transfers. So for example, so if you have 40 files that you want to transfer, if you could get that full concurrency of 20 if you set your pipeline depth to 1. Now if you set the pipeline depth to 2, you actually get there's a multiplicative effect, so that you actually end up with instead of 20 control channels with 2 files per channel, you end up with only 10 control channels with 4 files. And if you set the pipeline depth to 4, then each control channel would have 8 files in it, et cetera. And then for remote sites, going to other supercomputing centers or if you have your own endpoint somewhere else, we recommend that right now basically just kind of play with the settings and see what works best for you. So one important thing to keep in mind with the transfer rates is that the way Globus Online works is so it will transfer. So if you're doing checksums to verify file integrity, which we highly recommend. Basically it transfers the entire file and then does the checksum on that file. And then it transfers another file and does the checksum on that file. So that basically has the effective bandwidth, the effective transfer rate. And so just as kind of an expectation, between Lustre and HPSS, you should be able to get somewhere around 1 to 1.5 gigabits per second per file when you have the checksums enabled. We've seen aggregate transfer rates up around at least 18 gigabits per second if you're taking advantage of that concurrency. And then if you're transferring to remote sites, we've seen kind of on the order of about a gigabit per second there with checkpoints. Moving on to slide 17. So we highly recommend that you use checksums. We have seen, we don't see errors too often, but they do occur. And if you don't have the checksum on, then there won't be any way that you know that your file is corrupted. So just as an example here, kind of over time, over the last few months, I've just kind of randomly done some transfers. I set up with a script. So I transferred, I did a whole bunch of transfers and I only saw 20 errors, but there's still 20 errors. And they do tend to occur in bursts. I think 15 of those errors or so came. All those happen just on during one day. You know, so if there are hardware problems, then you kind of get those bursts of errors. Slide 18, two other notes. So when you transfer files to Blue Waters Lustre, they inherit the stripe settings of the directory that you're transferring them to. And then finally, it's very important to keep in mind that we've seen pretty slow staging of files on HPSS. So when you're transferring files from HPSS to Lustre or to a remote site, if any files that are on tape have to be, the tapes have to physically be gotten using robotic arms and then the data has to be retrieved from there. And so they're working on trying to make the staging more intelligent, but at least so far we've only seen there was one case where its user was only seeing about two, basically a concurrency of two coming off of tape. He saw good bandwidth, was able to transfer 16 files to HPSS, but when he was trying to transfer them off later, because they were on tape, he was only seeing a concurrency of two. So you want to keep in mind, you want to try to limit the number of files that you transfer to HPSS. If you're transferring hundreds of thousands of files, it may take a very, very long time to get those files off later. So last slide, slide 19, just a summary of the points I've been talking about. So we really want you to use Go, use Globus Online for your data transfers. Don't use SCP, SFTP, RSync, or anything like that. For most simple transfers, go ahead and use the Globus GUI. You need some extra power, then you can use the command line interface. You want to try to balance, large files with the number of files so that you get good bandwidth and good concurrency. Be careful, again, how many files you write to HPSS, because it may take a long time to get them off later. We recommend that you tar up files if necessary. And if you're tarring up lots of large files or making lots of large files using tar, you probably want to do single compute node jobs for that. The login nodes do have, there's a limit on how long you can run a particular process on the login nodes, and it will be killed at a certain point if it goes too long. And in any case, it's better if we don't have many, many users doing TARs all at the same time. And so we really recommend that you use checksums, and if you have any questions, need some help with using the command line interface, or if your transfers are slow and you don't know why, just send us an email, create a ticket, and we'll be able to help. I think that's it. Any questions?
Sounds pretty quiet. All right. Well, thanks, Ryan. That was very, very useful. In fact, we've had some Globus Online transfer tickets come in during this presentation, actually. So, great time. Thanks a lot. So, that's all we have, I believe, for today's Blue Waters user call. Our next call will be in January, third Monday in January. We will send out an announcement. Visual 13. If they light up. Okay. We'll have to check and see if that conflicts with our local Martin Luther King holiday. Forgot about that. I'll send out an email or in conjunction with other announcements regarding expected service support over the holidays. University of Illinois, we have a couple of reduced service days, so we'll have limited staffing support during that time. We'll send that announcement. We will have some C staff that are going to be on call or available. One person will be watching the queue, so we will be able to respond to tickets in a reasonably timely manner. And we'll send out an announcement tomorrow regarding the change of the NIT order and also the implementation of the scratch purging of empty directories. And we look forward to hearing any comments from people who have suggestions about additional topics or the register call. And we'll talk to you guys back in January. Thank you.